for a second. God, I want to invite you into this room and into all of our hearts here tonight, not because we don't know that you're already there, but because I want you to know that you are welcome. Amen.
Amen.
Okay. I've never spoken in front of a group this large before, so bear with me. And I only have 10 minutes, which isn't enough time for the size of my ego. So what happened, what it was like, and what it's like now. I come from a long line of alcoholics on both sides. Have an alcoholic father, a crazy mom, and my alcoholic grandfather who died of alcoholism, his late wife died an alcoholic death, and so on and so on, and it just goes back. And for me, it started at the age of 6. I took my first drink and I absolutely loved it, and I didn't know why until years later, and it was because it eased all of my problems. I was a very troubled and abused child. So at that point, it was the solution. And I remember I had went through a lot of abuse, and I came home and crying. And my grandmother, she was raising me at the time, and I was being abused by my babysitter and her son. And she handed me a beer, and I drank it, and I loved the effect. Like, I'll never forget it, so vivid. And I remember the next day asking her for more, and she didn't, she pretended like she didn't know what I was talking about. So as I got older, I went through high school completely straight edge, and then I got to college, and that was like a whole nother ball game for me. So that's when things got really bad, when my alcoholism took flight, along with everything else you can imagine, because there was drugs are a part of my story. There was a point in time where alcohol stopped working for me. And by the end of it, I ended up with 14 felonies, about 15 arrests, and I had been through 2 rehabs, 3 jails, and 3 halfways before I finally got this thing. You know, you talk about beating yourself over the head, or, as they speak in the big book, putting your hand on the stove. I was just like repetitive, over and over again. So I finally I got into rehab, and my God is a comedian, and he is almighty, because I got into this rehab and I thought I was doing really well, and I had this thing called sobriety, and I get out and Pasco County Sheriffs are waiting for me in Pinellas County, and they rearrest me on charges that I had 2 years prior, and I had to sit in jail for another 8 months. And I remember going to AA meetings in there and reading my big book, and the whole time, like, questioning why is this happening to me, why? And I finally get out and I end up in this halfway house, ACE, and I get kicked out within a month, and I end up in HasLife, and the house manager there says, "I recognize you." And I said, "Do you?" She says, "Yeah, you checked into Simply Hope in Pinellas County before you were arrested, and God saved your butt that day." I'm like, "What do you mean?" She's like, "Well, everyone in your house was drinking and drugging, and the house manager was arrested, and he's being sent to prison." So the whole time I sat in jail for another 8 months, I questioned God, and the whole time he was protecting me. So that was one of the big spiritual experiences that I had that brought me and kept me here. It didn't last, though, because I had 3.5 years of what I thought was good sobriety. It obviously wasn't that good, because I ended up having a relapse. So my new sobriety date now is July 7th of 2016. And this time has been different for me. God has granted me with a lot of gifts, a wonderful sponsor and a wonderful working sponsee today. Man, there's so much more to talk about. So I guess, sorry guys. What was I gonna say? I'm so nervous, I'm so sorry. So throughout sobriety, God has granted me a lot of gifts. And through working the steps, I've come to realize a lot of things. In redoing 4 and 5, it really opened my eyes to my faults. And really doing it thoroughly this time, actually. I thought I was thorough last time, but it turns out there was a lot that I omitted. So this time was different. And then a lot of great gifts that have come from it also is how I mentioned I went through a lot when I was coming into sobriety with all my arrests and everything. There was a point in time where when I came back to probation before I completed, I remember walking in and all of the probation officers knew me. They were like, Berrios is here, Berrios is here. They're shouting down the hallway. All these probation officers are coming out. And they're like, we can't believe that you made it back. And my old officer says, I've been an officer for 20 years and you are my top 10 worst cases I have ever seen. And if you make it, you'll be a miracle. So over Christmas, I walked into that probation office, you know, cause they are on my amends list. And I walked in there with a Christmas card for them. And it was amazing. They were all so happy to see me and hear that I was working this program, and they couldn't believe that I had the courage to step in there. And I said to them, I said, it's great that I can like walk through these halls without being in fear or anxiety or like, you know, worry or looking over my shoulder, you know, and I'm able to be here. And thank you guys for helping save my life. So that was just, another amazing moment, another spiritual experience that I had in my sobriety and all these things that I've been able to do. I have been able to be a daughter, be a sister, help raise my sister, who is I brought into sobriety with me. I have been able to be an honest friend, an honest employee, a lover. You know, I've been able to be all of these things because of this fellowship and because of the blessings that God has given to me in sobriety. Today, I know what it's really like to be a part of, and it's just absolutely amazing. Not too long ago, I did a DNA test to see what my ancestry was, and it turns out I am got DNA from 5 out of 7 continents. And I'm like, man, God is real. My sponsor says that she's going to have to make a new holiday for me. You know, and it's just this whole love that I have for humanity and like everyone, because at the end of the day, we're all just as equally as important as the next. Each alcoholic is just as important as the next. And I believe that God has a purpose for each and every one of us. And I believe that we are all his children and we are here to help each other grow and succeed. And thanks for letting me share.
Thank you, Bianca. And now Chelsea will be coming up to read the traditions.
I'm Chelsea, I'm an alcoholic. The 12 traditions of Alcoholics Anonymous. 1, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. 2, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants, they do not govern. 3, the only requirement for AA membership is the desire to stop drinking. 4, each group should be autonomous except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. 5, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. 6, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise. Thus, problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. 7, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. 8, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. 9, AAs as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
And Jennifer will now give out the chips.
Hi everyone, I'm Jennifer, I'm an alcoholic. And here at the Fourth Dimension Group, we give out chips to denote lengths and time of sobriety. And the first chip that we give out is a silver 24-hour chip. Is there anybody new to Alcoholics Anonymous? Is this your first meeting or like to come up and get a chip? Daniel. And that's our new friend Daniel. And we have a red chip for 1 month, 30 days. Anybody have 30 days or 1 month?
Red.
Those are our friends, Greg, Mark, and Robin. Our next chip that we give out is for 2 months, 60 days, 2 months. Anybody got 2 months? We have Ashley, Mike, and TJ. We have a 3 month chip. Anybody got 90 days? 90 days. 3 months. Okay. And then we have 6 months. Those are our friends Cisco and Matt. The next one here is 9 months. Having a baby? 9 months? Not yet? Okay. Keep coming. And then we have a gray chip for 1 year. Anybody celebrating a year? And those are our friends Amy and Rachel celebrating a year. 1 year. And then we flip this gray coin over for multiple years. Anybody have 2 or more years they're celebrating? That's our friend Kathy with 37 years. Congratulations, Jean, with 38 years. Willie, 2.5 years. And this is our friend Willie with 2.5 years. Congratulations. Before I mention the big book, I just want to offer one more time, in case somebody didn't hear me or understand, if you want to surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous, you're welcome, and come on up here and get a 24-hour chip. Okay. And then we do have big books. If you are not able to afford one or you need one, you can see me or the chairperson or any other home group member after the meeting. We'd be glad to get one to you. Thank you.
Our second speaker of the night will be Dave.
Hello, everyone. My name is Dave Foles, and I'm an alcoholic. Can you hear me all right? Good, I wouldn't want you to miss a damn thing. My home group is the Why It Works group, and it's the best group in the whole world. If you don't feel that way about yours, don't screw up another one, but try to help them become the best group in the whole world. And my sobriety date is January the 7th, 1974. I was just a baby when I came here. And literally, I was 28 years old when I walked into my very first meeting. Kind of coincidentally, I was invited to go to AA in 1964. I'd just been in an automobile accident. I had crashed a Corvair, not a Corvette, a Corvair. And if you're not sure one of those is, and you're like under 30, ask your parents. They might know. If not, your grandparents will surely remember. But I crashed a Corvair. They had engines in the rear, and I crashed it head on into a concrete telephone pole. And at speeds that I have no idea what they were. I was in a blackout. I went to the hospital that night about 2 o'clock in the morning. They called my parents. This was in Los Angeles, California. They called my parents, who were in upstate New York, and woke them up in the middle of the night and scared the dickens out of them. They didn't know my parents didn't know if I was gonna live or die. All the surgeons did, the people in the hospital knew I would, but I had 100 stitches in my face. I used to be pretty good looking, but after the surgery, they really messed me up pretty bad. But at any rate, it was the next day that my roommate's brother, who was 18 at the time, and had been sober a year. My roommate asked me if I wanted to go to a meeting with his brother. I was 19 at that time. And I knew a little bit about his brother, and his brother had smoked a lot of pot. When I'd heard that, I said, no, I don't need AA, I never smoked any pot. So I didn't go. But I was invited to go, and I'm thankful that I didn't go, because I wasn't ready yet. I had some more cars to total, some more people to owe money to, and some a job to nearly lose, and credit card companies and household finance to abuse. And so, but at that time, I just want to go back to one other. I'll pick up from there in a minute. I have a tendency to jump around. It's always been like that for me. It's not something new. But when I remember drinking the first time, I'm not sure how old I was, but I was a young, just a kid, and my dad believed in serving wine to his sons, his kids. We didn't have any sisters, so his sons, on Thanksgiving. And I forgot my water, didn't I? Thank you. So, is this timer on?
It's recording me.
My name is Jim, and I'm an alcoholic. The rest of that doesn't make any sense. No. So my dad gave us a glass of wine for Thanksgiving, and he always, when we were little, he mixed it with 7-Up, and I remember always wanting another one, but we only got one. And as best as I can ever, that I can recall, that's the only time I ever drank one drink. From the time I was old enough and able to, I always had more than one. I never drank one drink, never ever, other than those days. And I remember that, and I remember the way it made me feel, and I liked it. I liked it a lot. I couldn't hardly wait for Thanksgiving. I was just praying for Thanksgiving. But now I remember the first time I got drunk. I want to share that with you because that was a fun night. I lived in a small community. We had a flashing yellow light on one direction and a flashing red light on the other direction in the little community that I'm from. And we had a little grocery store there. It was an IGA. And I worked there as a teenager, as a bag boy. And so I figured out that we could steal the beer out of the back pretty good. So we stole a case of beer out of the back, my brother and I and the store owner's son. And on Friday night, we went on a camping trip. Now, we only went like as into the woods as far as you needed to go so you couldn't be seen. That was it. And pitched our tent and started drinking those beers. And I remember getting drunk have you ever laid down in bed and the bed was spinning around? So you sit up and it kind of stops. Well, when you're laying on the ground, you can't, sitting up doesn't help. The earth is still going around and around. And that's what I remember. I remember that I was out of control. And I remembered that. I didn't care, but I remembered it. I was about 14 or 15, and from that day till the 7th of January, 1974, or actually till the 6th of January, I had my last drinks 43 years ago tonight in a little town of Mexico, New York. Anybody ever been there? You have. I'd like to talk to you later. I want to know if they're still looking for me. Snowing? Yeah, we used to have two seasons in Mexico, New York. We have winter and the 4th of July. And it usually rains on the 4th of July. So at any rate, where was I anyway? Where? In the woods, oh yeah. I don't know when I'm going to come out of the woods either. So anyhow, I drank like that right up until the last time that I drank. The last time that I drank, I had 6 drinks. And the only reason I had 6 drinks because I had a dollar. And the draft beers were 15 cents a glass. And 6 times 15 is 90 cents, and that's all I could get was 6 of them. And I went home and I started my little venture to AA. But between that time, I had a lot more challenging times, let me say that. I worked for American Airlines, which was kind of interesting. When I came to AA, I had a uniform that had a AA here, a big AA on my back. Of course, it was January, so I had an AA hat and an AA coat, and I had my AA uniform that I came to AA in. But I worked for them for all of my adult years that I worked, and I got into an awful lot of trouble. The only thing that saved me was the union. I was a member of the union, and I was able to be saved by the union, or I would have made my goal early. My goal in life was to raise my kids, and at 40 years old, I would retire to a park bench, a newspaper, and some wine. That was my goal. I wanted to live on a park, sleep on a bench, and drink wine all the time. That was my life's goal, as soon as I could get those children raised. I almost made it. If I'd have lived 12 more years, I might have, but I couldn't. So the last year and a half or 2 years that I drank pretty much around the clock. And I know that I couldn't work days anymore. I just couldn't make it to work in the morning anymore. I just couldn't do it. I couldn't even get home by morning most of the time, let alone go to work. And so I went on a night shift, a midnight shift, where I went to work at 11 o'clock at night and came home at 7 in the morning. And that way I was able to drink all day and pass out and go home. I drank all night. We worked in, when the planes came in, we cleaned them up and picked up the newspapers and raided the refrigerators, got all the, anybody remember those little red bottles of Lancer's wine they used to have on the airline? Oh, that was good. And so we used to get those and the beer off of them and drink all night, drink most of the day. And just, that was my cycle, just daily, and I didn't pay any bills. I was always behind on my rent. My phone was always getting shut off. Matter of fact, my phone guy is a high school buddy of mine. He spends the winters in the Keys and usually stops and sees me one way or on either the way back or the way down, and spends a day and he doesn't drink, and he's glad that I don't. And so, but he's a guy that knew me since I was 10, 11 years old. So that was my drinking. And I want to share with you one really kind of bizarre drinking story, because it's a good example of how distorted this alcoholic's perception gets. One night, I'd been drinking and I was pretty well drunk, and I had a 1967 Bonneville convertible. It had the big engine in it and the 8 lug wheel nuts, and it had buckets. It was a gorgeous car. I would love to have it today, but that's what I drove, and I swapped cars with my brother. That night, there was a little hangout in the town that we lived in that people just stopped and kind of hung around in, and my brothers were there. And so I borrowed his car, and I took off down through town, and as I was going through town, I looked in the rearview mirror, and I saw red lights flashing. And I thought, I'm going to outrun them. They're not going to get me. And so my brother had a nice little Firebird, and I hit the Firebird, I hit the gas pedal to the metal and went tearing down through the rest of town, slid around a corner and out into the country where I led the town sheriff and the deputy sheriffs and the state police on a high-speed chase through the countryside in that area of New York. And finally, I got tired of running this race, and I pulled the car over, I jumped out of the car, and one of the policemen hollered, "Dave Foles," and I said, "No, it's not me." And I and I ran into a swamp, and I was wearing sandals and cut-off jeans and a t-shirt. And I was laying there in that swamp, and this was in like July. It was hot, and it was in mosquitoes, and it was 12 o'clock at night, and I beat them. I got away from them, and they were surrounding. They were shining lights everywhere, and so I went deep into the woods and came back out about a quarter of a mile down the road. I walked into somebody's front yard who was outside watching all the lights down there. They're probably thinking, what is going on down there? And I walked out of the woods, dripping wet, cut off shorts, t-shirt, sandals, and said, "What's going on down there?" And I'm sure he looked at me and thought, "Let's see. There's cops down there looking for somebody, and you just walked out of the woods." So he grabbed me, and he tried to hold me, and I broke free, and I staggered off and crawled up into the hayloft in his barn, and I was hiding in there, and he started screaming to the sheriffs and the cops, I got him, and so they came up and surrounded the barn, and one of the deputy sheriffs, this is a small town I grew up in, was a guy I went to high school with. And he came to the barn and he said, "Dave, you know who this is?" And I said, "Yeah." He said, "If you don't come down out of there, we're going to send a dog in to get you." Now, in those days, police dogs were fairly newly trained, and they... I'd seen the results of what they could do to a person, and I didn't want my arms chewed off. And so I came out of there, and they took me back into the little town that I lived in. And now I lived in a little town where, when you had this kind of excitement, they called the justice of the peace at home, and he came into the village, and they set up special sessions court for me. And at 2 o'clock in the morning, I was standing in front of the justice of the peace, and he said to me, "Ooh, I can smell the booze on you." And I said to him, "They don't pay you to smell me, they pay you to judge me." I gotta tell you, he wasn't a fan of mine. And my father had run against him for justice of the peace. So he knew, and my father and I's names are the same. So he knew me and my father quite well. So after some more shenanigans in front of the judge, he said the charges are driving while intoxicated, speeds in excess of 110 and a 55, and third degree escape. How do you plead? And I said, "Not guilty." He said, "The bail is $700. I said, "Would you take a check?" I didn't have one. All I had on was cut off shorts and a t-shirt anyway. He said, "I wouldn't take your check. I've seen them pinned up around town. Insufficient funds on them." He said, "But if you'll call your father, I'll let you go if he'll guarantee one of your brother's checks." So I had to call my father at 2 o'clock in the morning and tell him that there had been a terrible mistake made and that the bail was $700. He guaranteed it, and eventually I lost my driver's license. It was revoked. I fortunately the third degree escape was dropped. That was a jail time, the speeds were dropped, and the only thing that stuck was the DUI, and I lost my license. Now, what I want to tell you about perception is this. When I was driving down through town and looked in the rearview mirror, I saw the red lights change. I didn't see flashing lights. I saw the red lights change from the traffic light in this town. What screwed me up was after I took off, I went by a couple of cops that were parked a couple of blocks, and they saw this guy going 80 miles an hour through town and wondering, what is the matter with him? And they took off after me. So that's kind of my example of the perception of an alcoholic. Those were just traffic lights, and I thought the cops were after me. So that was kind of the way I drank. And I wasn't always chased by the cops, but usually by somebody. So within another year and a half, I was drinking really bad, and my first ex-wife said to me she wanted to move back to Los Angeles, or she said she wanted to go for a visit around Thanksgiving, and I said, go ahead. I worked for American Airlines, so I could fly her for free. So she went back to Los Angeles. We were living in outside of Syracuse, New York, and so she flew back, and she called me right around New Year's, and she said, I'm not coming home. I've had it with you. And I knew what she was talking about. I knew it was my drinking. I knew I had to do something about it. Now, I knew something about AA. I drank with a guy that was on a slip, who was out road testing, as we say. He was my drinking buddy. And I didn't know this at the time, but I found out later that his wife hated to see him drink with me because she thought I was a lot worse than him. And so, what I knew about AA was that if a guy wanted to drink, he just call another AA member and they'd talk him out of drinking. So I called up another high school friend of mine, and told him what I knew about AA and asked him if he would support my recovery program, and he said he would. So he took me home that night and he dropped me off at the bar that I did all my drinking in, and I said, thank you for helping me stay sober. I'm gonna go in here and have a couple of beers before I go home. And he said, okay. So that was when I had my last six beers. And I got up, that was a Sunday night, I got up on a Monday morning, and I didn't go to work, and I laid on my couch and I cried. And I felt sorry for myself, and I felt like dying. I felt terrible. I didn't want to live anymore. I didn't want to drink, and I didn't want to live. And the next morning, I did the same thing, only I just changed ends of the couch. And I laid there and I cried and I felt terrible. And I looked around my house because my ex-wife said, take a look around you. And I did. I looked around me, and we had a lot of stuff. Nothing worked, but we had a lot of stuff. I opened up the refrigerator and the freezer door would fall off, and open up the oven door and you had to keep a stick in the oven door to keep it on. And I had a washer and dryer. The washer didn't work. I had one of those washers. Most of the people in this group won't know what it is, a wringer washer. You know, the clothes, you feed them through the two little roller things. You might have seen one in an old movie, a Ma and Pa Kettle movie or something like that. But that's the kind of washing machine that I had. My house was a rented house. I was behind in the rent. I was behind in everything. I was looking around me and just feeling even worse, and decided that that the next day, on Wednesday, the 9th of January, I called my boss and I said, I got to talk to somebody. And I went and talked to him. He had just finished some EAP training, and he said, you sound like an alcoholic. And I felt relief. And people had been calling me an alcoholic for years before that, for since I crashed that Corvair. They'd been telling me I was alcoholic, and I just, no, I denied it. But when he said, that sounds like an alcoholic, he didn't call me an alcoholic, he said, it sounds like an alcoholic, I felt relief. And he said, I think you should go home and call AA. So I did. I went home. I got the phone book out. I'm in the phone book, and the whole county that I lived in is about the size of a Living Sober. And there was three numbers in there for Alcoholics Anonymous, and I called them all, and nobody answered. And they were, in those days, they were all people's home phone numbers that was listed for AA. And I called them, no answer. So I started to think, bad thing to do. Don't do that when you're real new. Get yourself a sponsor before you do a lot of thinking. And so I was trying to think, and I thought, well, alcoholics got to be in trouble with the law. So I'll call the sheriff. I'd been in trouble with the law most of my drinking career. So I called the deputies, the sheriff's office, and they didn't know that they had a meeting right below the dispatch where I called. They didn't know they had a meeting that night. They didn't know that. They said they couldn't help me. So I thought, well, emergency room. I've been to the emergency room. This is an emergency. It's my emergency for me. And so I called the emergency room, and I said, this is an emergency. I need to talk to somebody in AA. You got to help me. And in those days, every hospital didn't have a detox center or a treatment, 28-day treatment center. They didn't know what to do with me. So they told me they couldn't help me. So I started to think some more, and I started to think, well, I'll call the county extension people. They have mental health workers there. Alcoholics got to have mental health problems. I don't, but you do. And so I called them, and I started talking to somebody there, and somebody there wanted to know where I lived, so I hung up. I'm not having a mental health worker come and see me. So I decided I'm going to call the emergency room back again, and I'm not going to hang up until they help me. And I called the emergency room back, and I said, I'm not hanging up until you help me. And so they said, okay, we'll see what we can do. They said, they came back, and they said, we got three numbers here for you. I said, good, give me them numbers. So they did, and I called those numbers, and they were the same numbers in the phone book. Still no answer. But eventually that day, I got a hold of a guy and made arrangements for him to pick me up to go to a meeting. I lived a couple of blocks from a little diner right in downtown Mexico. Only one diner, anyway. And so I was sitting there, and I was in my AA uniform, and this guy pulled up in the car and walked in, walked right over to me and said, Dave. I said, yeah. He said, come on, let's go. And I did. Now, I got to tell you, that's the first time I ever remember going off with a man I didn't know, just out of that I remember. Drinking don't count, but that's the first time that I ever went off with somebody I didn't know like that. And so I went to my first meeting, and they abandoned whatever topic they had, and they talked about the first three steps. And Glenn was a janitor at the local high school. He'd been sober 17 years, chewed off part of his tongue in the DTs. Hard to understand, but he shared from his heart. Chet got sober at Attica State Prison, had DTs and all kinds of stuff. He saw all kinds of strange animals and things coming after him. And I thought, well, them guys really need AA. One you can't understand, the other one's crazier than a loon. But I felt something there that I'd never felt before. So I decided that I would keep going, and I kept going. And the next week I went back there. This is Fulton, New York. It's the oldest group in upstate New York, to my knowledge. And they had a little different format than most of the groups. When you got there, they said, everybody under 90 days, raise your hand. I thought maybe it was going to be a prize or something. So I raised my hand along with a couple other guys. I said, okay, you guys go downstairs with so-and-so. You're going to have a beginner's meeting. Now, beginner's meetings weren't the same as they are now. This beginner's meeting, what they told you was, you need to get a sponsor, need to get a big book, need to go to meetings. If you want 2 cups of coffee, get 2 cups of coffee before the meeting starts. If you got to pee, pee before the meeting starts. We don't want you up walking around during our meeting. And they said, and we don't want your filthy barroom language in here. And that was a beginner's meeting. And so I learned some basic etiquette there. I learned to sit through a meeting for an hour. I learned to do things like that. And I went to a meeting, and after about 2 weeks, I got a sponsor. And my sponsor, Ed, was sober 3 years. He lived about 20 miles from me. He came every night and picked me up. 2 minutes. Is that for me or for you? Okay. He came. I'm just teasing. So he came and picked me up every night, 20 miles, drive 20, 30 miles to go to a meeting, bring me back home, and go back home. 4 or 5 nights a week, he drove 80 to 100 miles every night to take me to a meeting in January, February, March, in some of the coldest, nastiest weather in the country. And I learned from that experience, because he would never take gas money, he would never take anything but a thank you, and he always said to me, thanks for making this 12-step call on me. And that was that's how I learned AA. I learned AA going to meetings in the back seat where I was told to learn how to listen. And so I did. And ultimately, that's how it was, what happened, and how it's like today. My life today is a lot of fun. I enjoy my life today. I have good friends today. I have a career. I never had a job. I had that one job with American Airlines for almost 10 years, and now I've been with the VA for going on 17. I love what I do. I've been divorced twice. I married a woman in AA. We had a great marriage for many, many years, and ultimately 3 years ago, Doug was divorced and have been single for the last 3 years. Met a really nice lady who I worked with, who I went out with a couple of times. She drank a little heavy, but I didn't think too much of it. She was a lot of fun. I would never embarrass her by saying she's here tonight. But anyway, she, after last January, she came to me and she said, I'm afraid to tell you this, but I've been going to AA. Well, that's good. She's been a friend for 6 years and a close friend for the last 2 year and a half. And we've had some great times. So my life is wonderful. What I want to say to you is if you're new and you're around 28 years old or 21 or 38 or 58 and you're new, this is worth it. This really is. This is a lot of fun. This is a whole different life. This is a life that you'll never imagine. Do you have a 1 minute? No? What do you do, throw something? All right. So it's a wonderful life. It's just absolutely wonderful. I wouldn't change anything in my life sober. There's a couple of things that happened in my drinking life with my family that I wish they hadn't happened, but they did, and I can accept those today. So what I want to say to you is give yourself a chance. This is really, really worth it. If it wasn't, I wouldn't still be here. And neither would the ladies that celebrated 37 and 38 and the other people that I know that are here for. I was in a meeting last night. I went to a meeting. I didn't know I went to this to a Spanish speaking meeting, but it was a good hour and a half. I don't know what they said, but it was, they sure were nice to me. They brought me coffee and donuts, and it was great. I just want to say thank you for the gifts that you've given me. And I want to thank you for showing me the way to a God of my own understanding, a God who I know loves me, loves you, and will care for you in all your needs, in all your times, no matter how bad it gets. And I can tell you that it can get stark raving sober too, and I've been there, stay long enough so that you can find this power that's within you. It's really within you. You just have to find it, and it's not a very hard search. We have 12 steps to find that power within you. And maybe another time I'll talk about how that happened to me and what I did there. But tonight I just want to say, I just want to kind of think of Dr. Bob. Dr. Bob talked about giving up for good and for all, abandoning yourself to this way of life. And I urge you to do that. It's really worth it. Thank you.